Eve, August, Fáilte Rash to the Crazy House Prices podcast with me, Ciarán Mulqueen. Today, we are speaking to Dara Turnbull of Housing Europe. It's a big conversation. It's solutions focused. There's a lot in it. So I recommend you get a notepad and pen, take down some notes and listen to the end, because at the end, I do ask him to give me his like top three recommendations that the government could and should be doing to improve the housing crisis here. I will note that we don't really touch on the homeless figures or ways to alleviate homelessness. In my opinion, that needs its own podcast episode, or even its own entire podcast, to be honest. And it's something that I want to talk to him about, because that is something he does a lot of work on. But it's a very, very interesting conversation. Lots of really detailed solutions in it. A lot of examples from around Europe, what works really well. And that is what I think, you know, we should be focusing on. I think we all know the problems. No one gives out about it more than I do, but we really do need to look towards solutions. And then when government politicians are, you know, campaigning for your vote, you need to say to them, well, if you do this, I'll give you my vote and it might help. But anyway, you're going to hear a little ad now and then we'll get straight in. I'm going to pause the podcast for a second because I want to talk to you about a company called Financial Planning Matters. Their website is fpms.ie. This is a company that I know very well, and the team behind it are fantastic. It's a small Irish company that believes that financial planning should be accessible, easy to understand, and affordable for everyone. That's why they offer personalized financial advice that's tailored to your unique needs and goals. Their team of expert financial planners will look at your current financial situation and develop a personalized strategy to give you a roadmap to achieve your financial goals. It's not just about setting up a pension or investing your money. They'll consider all aspects of your finances to help you get to where you want to be. So that could be saving for your deposit. It could be knowing where to invest your children's allowance. It could be maybe you have loads of money and you want to know what to do with it. So their customer service is incredible. I've been using them for over a year now and I cannot recommend them enough. So check out fpms.ie. Now, back to the podcast. Now, today on the podcast, I have with me Dara Turnbull from Housing Europe. So you're very welcome, Dara.
Thanks for having me.
And if you want to maybe just tell the listeners what it is briefly that you do, what your job is.
Yeah, sure. So as my accent probably gives away, I'm originally from Ireland, from Dublin, but I've been kind of living and working on the mainland of the continent for the last couple of years. So I work at Housing Europe, which is based in Brussels. And basically what we do is we're the European Federation of Public Cooperative and Social Housing Providers. So basically it means that we kind of work at the EU level to make sure that the needs of kind of particularly vulnerable households and people who need access to kind of decent, affordable housing can be sought, can be looked after. So I guess you could say that we do a bit of lobbying with the EU, but I think lobbying is a bit of a dirty word. But when you tell people that you're lobbying on behalf of kind of people who are really struggling to meet, have their housing needs met, then I think people kind of think, oh, okay, well, maybe lobbyists cannot just be kind of a bad thing. So yeah, I mean, and what I do kind of day to day would be mostly focused on kind of looking at data and different kind of trends. So trying to see, like at the moment, looking at things like inflation, looking at interest rates, which I know is kind of a big deal. If you're trying to get a mortgage, interest rates are probably going the wrong way in terms of what you'd want them to be going. And then just kind of looking at general housing trends from across Europe and trying to see kind of what's going on, try to anticipate any potential problems that might be coming up, and then kind of put forward solutions that could help to try and mitigate that, to make sure that people who are living in vulnerable situations, particularly, don't lose their homes or don't find themselves kind of younger people, for example, who you'd know well, living back with their parents in their kind of 20s and 30s when they really ought to be kind of living independently. So yeah, I do a lot of different things, and it's a really interesting piece of work. It's really great organization, and yeah, look, happy to be here and talk through some of it.
Yeah, so not all lobbyists are bad. I guess it's like that, you know, when people go traveling, you learn a lot more. You know, when someone's been traveling, they always come back and they're like, oh my god, this thing is amazing that they do over there. Like I always remember going to Portugal and they have these giant underground bins, and I'm like, that's just so clever. Everybody's waste goes into one place, and you know, you're not falling over wheelie bins on the path and all that kind of stuff. But you know, that's the benefit of you being over there and the benefit of us being in the EU, that you get access to all of these solutions that maybe we should and could be doing here in Ireland. So I guess first question, are there any kind of European countries that have successfully navigated a housing situation similar to Ireland's? Because as we all know, it's catastrophic where we are in terms of prices, in terms of homeless figures, in terms of lack of building, lack of supply, where prices have gone. So are there any other countries that are kind of similar to ours? And if so, what strategies have they employed that has kind of improved things?
Yeah, it's a question I actually get asked all the time from people back home. And kind of the thing is, yes and no. So it's not really a simple answer. I can't really point to any other country in Europe that has the exact mix of problems that Ireland has. So maybe in some countries, yeah, like you mentioned, we have problems around supply, problems around affordability or regulation or homelessness, but they're kind of to a different extent or because of different factors. So kind of what I try to emphasize to people is that every country is kind of unique, but at the same time, there are obviously global factors. So, I mean, without going too much into the weeds, you know, there's nothing stopping someone like a hedge fund or someone from, I don't know, Germany buying up a block of flats in Dublin and vice versa for that matter, you know. So we kind of, there is an element of global capital that has an impact, but by and large, why Ireland's housing situation is the way it is kind of mostly down to local factors, political factors, cultural factors, historical factors, whatever, you know, population growth, which went into a lot of detail in the recent report. So I can't really say Ireland needs to be more like country X, because country X has different kind of dynamic than we would have. But I mean, if I pick out a few points, so on the lack of supply, so yeah, as I mentioned, I wrote on behalf of Housing Europe, on behalf of the Renew group in the European Parliament, specifically Barry Andrews, who is an MEP for Dublin. I have to give him the props for funding the research. We kind of looked at kind of the Irish housing situation and maybe what Ireland could learn from other countries. And one of the things that we point out in the report is that if you look at kind of the targets for new housing construction under Rebuilding Ireland, which has now been updated to be Housing for All, if you look at kind of the targets that were set out in terms of annual delivery of new homes, the public sector, so that would be local authorities or approved housing bodies, they kind of a little bit over-delivered versus what was kind of set out in the targets, and the private sector really under-delivered. And there are many reasons for that. But basically, if you have a lack of housing supply, trying to say, okay, we just kind of hope that the private sector, which is a private company, which makes its own decisions, it's under no obligation to do what the government wants it to do. We kind of just hope the private sector will do, you know, the amount of delivery that's needed. That's kind of wishful thinking. And it's been kind of a recipe for disaster now for too long. I'm not knocking the private sector. They have a very important role to play. But clearly, the evidence from the past decade or longer is that they're just not capable or willing, or for whatever reason it might be, to deliver the amount of homes that the government kind of has been expecting them to deliver. And I don't really see why that's going to change in the future. If anything, we might actually go backwards in terms of their delivery, because, you know, interest rates are higher, you know, investors maybe are looking elsewhere for that return that they were getting previously from private, you know, build to rent apartments and so on. So basically what I would say on lack of supply is the government needs to be more ambitious, the state needs to be more ambitious, the local authorities need to be more ambitious, and we need to actually empower public institutions to kind of step into the void and deliver more housing. So, you know, I know that there are a lot of efforts at the moment, things like the Land Development Agency is getting off the ground. You have the Housing Finance Agency, which kind of gives very affordable loans for building affordable housing. You have the new cost rental housing, which is coming on stream. So the government is trying a lot of different things. You know, you have to give them credit where it's due. But I think they need to go even further in terms of the role that the state has to play and just kind of say, look, the private sector is a valuable partner in all this, but we're not really seeing the result from them that we should be seeing. And the problem is that the people who lose out are kind of the younger people, the people who are maybe, you know, living precariously with a private landlord, or people who are living at home with their parents, you know, the sort of people that you talk to online every day of the week, basically, you know, you know their stories very well. And that's the people who lose out. So the government just kind of needs to rethink its whole strategy there in terms of who is actually going to build the housing that we need in the country. Another one that's probably important for your listeners is kind of around the whole regulation. So obviously at the moment in Ireland, it's in the media every day, people being evicted from their home, people getting notices to quit, all the rest of it. And the problem is, like, I've lived, like I said, in Ireland, I've lived in Belgium, I've lived in France. I've rented in all three of those countries, so I've seen the kind of differences that comes with renting in Ireland and other countries.
And tenants,
and
right?
Exactly. And it's just like in Ireland, tenants have really weak rights. I mean, you know, I'm sure again you deal more directly with people who are experiencing kind of this on a day-to-day basis than I obviously do. You know, you hear stories of people getting notices to quit, they leave the home and then they see it's up on Airbnb, you know. Or people saying, oh, you know, my niece is moving up from the country to go to college, so you need to leave so she can kind of move in, and that kind of stuff. I mean, that kind of stuff just doesn't happen in other European countries. You can't just say to a tenant, yeah, actually, I need the home because this kind of like fairly weak reasoning, and yeah, then you have to leave. You know, it's just, you have protection. If you sign, for example, in Belgium, a 3-year rental contract, you're basically sure that you're going to be living in the home for 3 years if you want to. You know, there's no penalties for you leaving either way. So actually, you are a bit more mobile, because I know in Ireland, or at least when I lived in Ireland in the private rental sector, if we were leaving before the end of our contract, we were basically sacrificing our deposit, which kind of isn't really fair either, because, you know, you might be moving for a job or whatever. So it's a different kind of market, but I think Ireland needs to be really regulating the private rental sector a lot more. And actually, people would say, oh, look, if you regulate more, there'd be fewer people offering apartments and, you know, fewer people renting and so on. But the evidence is actually the opposite way. If you look at the two countries in Europe that have the highest percentage of people who rent their home rather than own their own home, they'd be Germany and Switzerland. And they're two of the countries with the most strictly regulated rental market. So actually, the evidence shows that when there's a really strict rental market that's solid, that's in place, that investors as well, like landlords in Ireland, are always complaining, you're constantly moving the goalposts. The regulation is this one day, the next day it's another thing. So I do have a bit of sympathy for landlords. So I think actually they would probably welcome a bit of predictability if they know, okay, look, here's the deal. This guy, he signed a 3-year contract. That's fine. He's there for 3 years. That gives me kind of a bit of peace of mind as the landlord. Everyone knows what the game is, and everyone kind of, that's fine. The evidence from Europe shows that when you have that kind of predictable system with strong regulation, the tenant benefits from not being evicted from their home arbitrarily, and landlord benefits from kind of knowing, okay, what's the situation for the next 3, 4, or 5 years with this tenant, and everything becomes predictable and easy. In Ireland, that's just not being the case. You know, they're just constantly moving the goalposts. Tenants are constantly living in fear of, you know, is that notice going to come through the door any day now, that kind of stuff. So yeah, they're probably two examples. I could go on all day, trust me. I have talked the ears off my friends in the pub many a night back home. So maybe do a 10-part series on this. But I mean, there'd be two things I'd point to you right off the bat, but I'm sure we get into some more later on.
Yeah, but it's so interesting, because during the eviction moratorium we had here in Ireland, landlords are going insane. They were going mad, and they're, you know, using that as an excuse for leaving the market and all the rest, even though we have more tenancies now than we did in 2016. But I guess that kind of rent or eviction ban we had here, it wasn't actually a ban, because you could still be evicted if you weren't paying your rent and if you're an antisocial tenant. But it basically just put us kind of on par with tenants' rights everywhere else in Europe, where, like, things like you can't evict someone for your niece moving up to go to college in Dublin, which is usually a lie anyway. But it's, as far as I know, they could only be evicted if the actual landlord was moving in, and then that's followed up on. They have to move in, otherwise there's big fines and things like that. So it's definitely one. It's a weird one, isn't it? Because you hear all the time in the commentary over here from landlords that the more regulation, the less chance we have of landlords coming in, but then the countries with the most regulation actually have the most number of rental properties. So it should, as you said, it shows that when there's a structure there and when there's actual enforcement and systems in place, everyone knows what the story is. Well, then it just seems to work a lot better. But I guess just kind of going back to, in terms of other countries and what they've done, if we're looking at, say, improving supply to try and bring down to try and make houses more affordable, are there any kind of policies around Europe that have worked in that, in terms of boosting supply? Because we're hearing, like, there's talk that, you know, the government fly these kites before budgets, and they're talking about, you know, giving landlords tax exemptions to try and keep them in the rental market and all the rest. But let's say just talking about buying a house, like, is there anything that's being done in Europe that has boosted supply, other than, you know, the state building more, in terms of, say, private supply even?
Yeah, I mean, one thing that I mentioned, that recent report for the European Parliament that we go into, is the cooperative housing model. So this cooperative housing is kind of a weird thing. So if you look at countries where cooperative housing would be really popular, it'd be most popular probably in Eastern Europe, where you would have had, like, a lot of people who would have previously lived in, like, kind of the communist period in public housing. And then in the 90s, all that housing was basically privatized. And you're talking about kind of multi-family apartment buildings, and they would have basically formed a kind of a cooperative structure just to manage the common areas and that kind of stuff. So that would be kind of one way of doing it. But the other place in which cooperative housing is really popular would be in the Nordic countries, particularly in Sweden and in Norway. And basically the way they have it there, they call themselves tenant owners, which is kind of a weird way of thinking about it. It seems like a contradiction in terms to be a tenant and an owner simultaneously, but that's the kind of way they look at it. So basically, if you think about it in Ireland, right, you have lots of people who are mortgage eligible, but they still can't buy that property. So the bank's saying, look, we'll give you this amount of money at this amount of term, but you know the supply isn't there for them to buy. But what would happen hypothetically if you took you plus your 10 mates who are also mortgage eligible and you pooled that mortgage eligibility to build something new? And that's basically what they do in the Nordic countries. They basically take 20, 30, 40 households, whatever it might be. They say, look, all of you can get access to mortgage, or maybe you're lucky, maybe you have an inheritance or some other money and you actually can buy with cash. But anyway, you have the money, you're good for it. We're going to take all of that money, we're going to pool it together, and we're going to build a new apartment block, whatever it might be. And so you own effectively your apartment, the common areas, the facade, that's all managed by the cooperative that you're a member of. And that's the way they do it. Now in Ireland, that would be really useful, because what if you think back before the crash, that's kind of like the pillar banks, AIB, Bank of Ireland, Anglo Irish. Yeah. They were lending to private developers to build housing estates and things. And that's why they got into so much trouble, because they were lending to these people to build new supply. When those apartments couldn't be shifted or when prices fell, then they ended up in all kinds of difficulty. And as a result of that, and as a result of tighter kind of mortgage regulations that have come in, or lending regulations rather, the two main pillar banks in Ireland, AIB and Bank of Ireland, haven't really been in that space basically since the crash. You know, So if you're looking at where the capital needs to come from to build homes that people can actually buy, it's coming from, you know, hedge funds, it's coming from pension funds, it's coming from all kinds of international capital sources, often at very high interest rates, which then kind of means that the minimum price that the developer can afford to sell at is obviously going to be a bit higher. And that comes down to, all, you know, questions around viability and all the rest of it. But the cooperative housing structure is kind of very clever. So basically, as well as having the kind of mortgage eligible households, you also have what they call a guarantor. Because if you think it, if you go to a bank and say, can you lend me 300K because I'm going to build my own home? The bank's going to say, well, no, actually, because what happens if you don't build the home and you can't repay the money? You have no collateral that we can basically, you've got no assets that we can come in and seize. Whereas if you're buying an existing property, like I think you did recently, and I did recently, you know, the bank basically says, okay, we'll lend you the money because we're happy where prices are. And if, you know, for some reason you can't repay that loan, you have an asset, which is the home. So we're going to come in, we'll take the home, and then we'll be made whole that way, right? So there's no risk for us as the lender. But if you're talking about a new home that doesn't exist yet, the bank can't come in and seize a home that doesn't exist, that they're not going to lend to you. So what they do in the Swedish approach basically is they, you know, you and your mates, you go to the bank and say, look, there's 30 of us here, we're going to build this block of apartments, but don't worry, we're good for the money because there's this guarantee fund behind us. So if we can't repay you because we lose our jobs or something goes wrong, this guarantee fund promises to repay you 100% to make you whole. So there's zero risk for you as the bank. The bank says, that's fine, I have my collateral. Here's your money, go off and build the apartments.
And who's the guarantee fund? Is it the state?
No. So in Sweden, for example, so they've been doing cooperative housing, I should say, for over 100 years, this kind of cooperative housing, right? So initially, there's two guarantee funds in Sweden. One of them is linked to the trade union movement, which is really strong in Sweden. So, I mean, most Swedish people are a member of a trade union. They pay their membership fees and so on. And within that, you're going back to historical times when a lot of Swedish people were working in factories and so on. Basically, the cooperatives sprung up to provide affordable housing for the workers who worked in the factories. And then the kind of cooperatives pooled all their resources to make the kind of guarantee fund. And today, that guarantee fund has its own kind of capital that's built up over 100 years, okay, kind of a war chest, if you like. So they kind of have that good to go.
That's hilarious. And then the guarantee. I cannot picture. Yeah. I cannot picture the INTO building houses for teachers.
I don't quote me on this, but I'd say if I actually look back in time, there must have been a period in time in which the trade union movement in Ireland was the INTO or someone involved in building housing.
Well, I guess the railway workers, the CIE works, and there's loads of things around the Jacor, the little cottages around Rathmines and stuff. I think they were all kind of worker built things. Maybe that's how they built them back then. But that's a really, what happens then? Say you're in one of those cooperatives and you want to sell and move. What happens then?
Yeah, then it works exactly as if you're selling a kind of an ordinary home that isn't part of a cooperative. So basically, you just go to the market. You say, okay, I want to sell my home. Who wants to buy it? There are different approaches. Sometimes the cooperative will say, no, you have to sell to another member of the cooperative. So, and just to say, yeah, it's kind of gets confusing. I think if people read the report, maybe it will be a lot clearer than what I'm explaining it here. But you have like the national cooperative. So you can join that national cooperative without actually living in one of their homes. And then when you do live in one of their homes, then you live in a cooperative, which is like literally just your building. So some people say you can only sell to another person who's a member of the national cooperative, and you pay like an annual membership fee of 20 quid or whatever it is, you know?
Okay.
So yeah, it's basically the same as if you're selling the home. And what's really actually clever about the cooperative model is most of them have a rule that says you have to sell to an actual, like a real person. You can't be selling to an investment fund.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's actually an anti-speculative measure as well. So basically it means that, okay, this block of 40 apartments, that's for ordinary owner-occupiers to use as their primary residence now and for always. There's no possibility of like a big investment fund coming in and buying apartments and, you know, converting to Airbnbs, and you have like problems with noisy neighbors and stag parties and all the rest of it that I've heard about recently in Dublin. So yeah, it's actually an anti-speculative measure, and it is like a really interesting way of delivering like actual genuine supply that people can buy themselves and kind of live in. And the cool thing is, if you are the first one through the door, if you're the one who's like coming together with your mates, it's your problem. It's your home. It's as if you're building your own home. So you get to say, I want the kitchen there, I want the bathroom there, and the whole thing is really built the way you want it. It's not built in a kind of very bland, impersonal way that a lot of kind of apartments are unfortunately built in many countries.
Yeah. So that's interesting. And you mentioned something there about, say, like anti-speculative measures. That's something that I think could be really good here in terms of, especially with existing stock, existing homes not being bought, not being sold to speculators, but I guess it's people's private property. They're entitled to sell it to whomever they please. Are there any countries that do have laws in place that say investors can't come in and buy my neighbor's house?
There are different regulations, like planning regulations and so on, that can be used. But one that I came across really recently, which is I think only came into force the end of last year, is in Wales. So they've updated the local planning legislation in Wales that basically says that for each home, you can within the actual planning, you can say if that home has to be for primary residency or not. So if you do have like a part of Wales, like particularly this is a problem apparently with like coastal towns, so a lot of people from England are coming and buying up like holiday homes.
Yeah,
you can come in and say no, in the local planning guidelines it says that home has to be a primary residence. So if you want to sell it, you can only sell it to someone who's going to use that actually as their primary residence. You can't sell it to anybody else, because otherwise you're in violation of planning guidelines. And then the council can come in and kind of like, you know, take whatever fines or measures they want against you. So you could do something like that. It would be very simple. You just basically, you have every address, you have the planning, you say, right, number one, whatever, Griffith Avenue, Griffith Park, that has to be used as a primary residence. So expect it, a private developer or whatever can't come in and buy that home. It has to be sold to a family or, you know.
I think that'd be a great idea. In terms of, say, so we're talking a little bit about supply, and then for me, the obvious thing is vacant housing. And you did a whole report on this recently, which I skimmed through. I wasn't able to read it all, but it's it's very in-depth, and it's on vacant housing and basically what our government could and should be doing. Because I know they have brought in this vacant home tax, which is separate. It's nothing to do with derelict homes. They're just vacant habitable homes. And it's three times the local property tax, which in my opinion is too low. Like, even our property tax is quite progressive in Ireland. I think Irish people living in Ireland don't understand how cheap our property tax is compared to a lot of other countries in Europe, and also in America is insane. So three times a low thing is, in my opinion, not enough of a stick to try and get people who are sitting on vacant homes to try and encourage them to bring them back into use. So what in the report, what kind of solutions or suggestions are there that our government could look at?
Yeah, I mean, I think the first thing to point out is that we do go into the report, the fact that there's two types of vacancy. So you have what we call involuntary vacancy, which is like a home that's vacant, not because the landlord is kind of, or not the landlord, the owner is kind of playing games or behaving in a kind of a speculative manner, but because, you know, there's problems. I mean, you know, there's problems with pyrite and mica and all the rest of it that we hear, which is really tragic around the country. Those homes aren't fit basically to be sold or to rent, or no one will buy them. So that's not your fault. That's a home that's vacant, but, you know, it's beyond your control. So we do make that distinction.
Yeah, and nursing homes and the Fair Deal scheme and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, there are homes that are always going to be vacant on a long-term basis for some really unfortunate reason, some difficult time in a person's life, and you don't be kind of punishing those people.
Yeah, legitimate reason.
Exactly. But then you have what we call voluntary vacancy. So it's a home that could be sold or rented, but basically the owner is seeing some opportunity there in basically keeping it vacant. You know, it could be a way of hiding capital. I mean, I've heard stories, I think Killian Woods in the Business Post had a few articles about this over the years, where people from different countries were buying up properties as basically a way to hide their assets abroad, you know?
Yeah.
With no intention. I mean, I think those stories are probably, well, I hope they're rare. I hope they're rarer than maybe some media outlets would have us believe. But yeah, that kind of thing can happen anyway. Or it could be simply the case where you have a vacant property, you could get a tenant in, but maybe they need to do renovation works or something needs to happen for that property to be brought back into use. And you kind of think, it's worth the hassle. Maybe I'm better off just kind of keeping it vacant for another couple of years because prices in the market seem to be going up and up. And what I'll do is I'll kind of keep an eye on prices and then I'll kind of think, okay, a year from now, 2 years from now, then might be a better time to sell because prices will be, you know, 10% higher at that moment than they are now. So yeah, it's purely kind of a speculation thing. It's just people basically trying to play the market, you know.
Or get around RPZ rules. If they leave it vacant for 2 years, then they can charge whatever rent they want if it was a super low rent before that. So there, yeah. there are reasons why there's legitimate vacancy and illegitimate vacancy. And the last census kind of broke it all down into how many are in which category. So that was great. But what kind of solutions then is there to, for those illegitimate ones, the ones where they are being speculative, what can be done to curb that?
Yeah. So again, the report, we go into two kind of ways. We have the carrot and the stick. So in one section, we kind of look at, yeah, if you want to be kind of nice about it, let's say you want to kind of be positive with people and work constructively, then there are whole loads of grants, subsidies, and kind of other support mechanisms that the government could put in place. If I can give you one of those. So in Estonia, they have this national public agency that's been set up called CredEx, which basically does many things, including giving really affordable loans to kind of low income households so they can buy their own property, maybe something for Ireland to consider. But the other thing that they do is they kind of offer the guarantee. So I mentioned earlier on about in Sweden, the cooperative has a kind of guarantee structure. So the bank would be made whole. CredEx kind of is a public guarantee fund effectively in Estonia. So again, what happens is, imagine there's a vacant property near you that you want to buy and it's going to cost you, I don't know, like 100 grand, but then you need to put another, say 100 into it to bring it back up to like a decent standard. You go to the bank, look for a mortgage. The bank's saying, okay, well, what we see here on paper is the value of that asset today is 100 grand. So we're not going to give you 200 grand because again, you can't repay that loan. We come in and seize the asset. We're 100 grand out of pocket basically. Hmm. So basically CredEx will say, okay, no. Look, give the guy 200 grand. Don't worry about it. If anything goes wrong, if Kieran can't repay his mortgage, we'll come in and we'll guarantee you and we'll pay back the money that's owed, right? So then the bank says, that's fine. We have our guarantee. Here's your 200 grand. So you pay 100 for the vacant property, you pay 100 for the renovations and that's it. Then it's treated like any regular mortgage or any regular asset. So that's actually a really simple measure because one of the things that there was a report out, I think it was from the Chartered Surveyors in Ireland a couple months ago, in which they had this really eye-catching headline, like half of vacant properties basically are unviable. Like half of vacant properties can't be brought back into use because the difference between the current value and like the cost of renovations and then the post-renovation value is like just too out of whack. So the guarantee fund is one way of getting around that.
Yeah.
And then the other thing is that obviously if there's a vacant property and say, go back to my original example, you'd pay 100 grand for the renovations, 200 grand total in, but let's say the post renovation value of the property will be less than 200 grand, then you're kind of thinking that doesn't make any sense.
Well, the original value was too much then.
Exactly. The original value, the 100 grand you're paying for the original vacant property was clearly too much. It should all work out. The cost of renovations plus the cost of property should work out to the post-renovation market value. But the reason that the original 100 grand that you would pay for the property doesn't make sense is that, again, so we came back to landlords, I keep on saying landlords, it's Freudian slip. It could be landlords, but it's more like much as likely to be an owner, someone who's inherited a property, whatever. But yeah, the owner, I should say. You know, they're thinking, I can sit this property. You know, I can be a bit unreasonable. I can look for that 100 grand because maybe I'm paying three times the property tax, but actually this value is appreciating so much every year.
Exactly.
That's a cost I can swallow because the profit I'll make in the long term is going to be much higher.
Yeah.
So you need to be really strict to those people and say, look, this is a housing crisis. We can't be affording you the luxury of kind of playing the market this way, you know?
And nor should society accept that either.
No, exactly.
We shouldn't be accepting that. It's I think it's that kind of broken windows theory, you know, when one starts to go derelict and are vague, like it has a knock-on effect to everywhere, and that impacts on the society around there, how people feel about how the pride people have in their area, and that's how you end up with these kind of like whole streets of dereliction. And it starts with vacancy. Like, a house doesn't go derelict from someone living in it, you know, it's usually down to vacancy. So talk to me about the any stick approaches there, because I think we give them enough carrots, I think we need more. And I use that phrase a lot, I'm overusing it, but we need to use more stick.
Yeah. Oh, well, I mean, there are actually some carrots I think are fair enough. Like, just very quickly, for example, in France, where I live here, there's a really good scheme where basically if you have vacant property, someone can come in, bring it back up to a decent standard, but then they have to basically hand the keys over to a social landlord for 10, 15 years. And the social landlord will basically rent that out to a social tenant who needs a home at an affordable rent. And basically in return for that, the person who bought the home, they get like a small break in their taxes, or they get kind of a break in whatever the cost of the renovations was, that kind of thing. So that's a fair enough approach.
Repair and lease scheme we had here.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. But I think in France it's been much more widespread, and there seems to be a pretty good uptake for it. Okay. Maybe it's just that fact that it seems to be quite quick and easy to actually access if you do want to buy a vacant property and hand the keys over. But yeah, I think something like the repair and lease scheme needs to be kind of maybe beefed up or reconsidered to see how could that be potentially kind of a way of kind of a win-win situation for people who want to do something with their community, kind of bring homes back into use and making sure that people actually have affordable housing. So that's, yeah, there can be good carrots, yeah, as well. But in terms of the stick, I mean, it's going to be nothing that will surprise anybody. It's going to be, you know, fines, penalties, increased tax liability, all that kind of thing. I mean,
what
just
kind
to
of
give
tax
you one
works? Yeah. What kind of, like, are you talking 10% tax rather than 0.9 or whatever it is?
You need to set the tax at a level that's going to make people really think, okay, it doesn't make any sense for me to hold on to this property. Because, yeah, like, again, you said earlier, if the property tax in Ireland is already pretty low, I mean, it's crazy. Like, my property tax here in France for a property that's nowhere near as valuable as what it would be if it was in Ireland is close to $1,000 a year. Mm. I don't think there are many households in Ireland who are paying $1,000 a year for the type of property that I have. You know, but again, all that's going into local services. That's probably a conversation for a different day. Local services in Ireland, like here in France, you wouldn't believe it. Like, we have swimming pools and AstroTurf pitches, you know, everywhere. It's crazy. Mm. Anyway, geez, I lost my train of thought. What was I saying?
So would it make sense then, say house prices are going up 5% every year and inflation is 6%, well then you'd be looking at maybe 11% minimum for it to be, you know, in any way effective.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you have to find that pain point for people. You have to say, okay, at what level of taxation do people say I have to do something with this? I can't be holding on to this property. I'm definitely losing money here. Even if I can sell the property at a higher price 2 or 3 years down the road, I'm losing money thanks to this tax liability that I have. But the important thing to say about that is that for that to be effective, you have to be able to detect vacant properties, which is something which is actually pretty difficult to do in many cases. If people want to, they have found all sorts of creative mechanisms of, like, basically like conceding that they have a vacant property, you know?
Yeah.
And actually in Ireland, it's interesting. So you mentioned earlier about the census and how it gave a breakdown of vacant properties, but trying to square those figures in the census with other complementary sources of data doesn't make any sense. Like, I think off the top of my head, the census said we had over 30,000 homes on census, like, they were vacant, but only on like a short-term basis, because basically like a new tenant was moving in, you know, the next week kind of thing, or they're vacant, you know, before the new owner was getting the keys. So they're kind of between tenancies or ownerships or whatever, right? But then you look on Daft for the same period of time as when the census were taken, I think there were like 800 properties to rent in the whole country. Mm. And yet they're saying there's 30,000 people between tenancies. Like, I mean, that just doesn't add up, you know?
Yeah.
So there's a lot of weird stuff in those census figures that they don't really trust.
But say to, because I know the enumerators for the census, they even knocked into neighbors and they were like, right, okay, do you know anything about the house next door? What's the story? Could they also look towards the ESB or Irish Water in terms of looking at, okay, look, the electricity hasn't been on in that house since 2015. There's obviously no one living there, or the water or whatever. And, like, I mean, technically, if a landlord wants to sit on a vacant rental property for 2 years because he wants to get out of RPZ regulations, he could, you know, leave a light on and go in every week and flush the toilet or whatever. But I think the census did show that there were over 30 or 40,000 houses that were vacant in 2016 and also vacant in 2023. So surely they would be your priority to focus on them, because you know for a fact that they've been vacant for 7 years. So really need to start punishing those type of people that are sitting on them. But I think everybody is always a bit miffed at how we have so few homes built every year. We've say 30,000. That's the figure they give us, but only around 8,000 are actually for sale. The rest are social, or the rest are built to rent and whatever. Like, say there's 8,000 for sale and there's 160,000 that are vacant. It's like, it's 20 years worth of supply technically, you know. And even if we got a quarter of them on, say we got 40,000 on stream in 1 year, that's increasing the supply of housing. Of, I know that 8,000 is new homes, but just to keep it simple, that's five times more in a single year. What that would do to supply, to prices then, would obviously drop the price. So in going back to your example of a vacant house and it's 100 grand to buy, well, if there are 30,000 vacant homes like that, well, then that 100 grand starts to drop, because if the person's not willing to accept less than 100 for that, well, then you move on to the next one out of the 40,000 or 30,000 or whatever. So it's kind of going back to that basic supply and demand. I know I'm simplifying things there, but I guess the kind of, to wrap up on the vacant thing, we basically just need to tax them a lot.
The first step would probably be to try to work constructively. Like, for example, in Amsterdam, they've now set up basically like a new unit that's focusing full time on vacant housing issue, right? Hmm. And the first step is actually just to contact the owner and say, okay, what's going on here? Yeah. Why is this home vacant? Try to see, is this a case of involuntary vacancy? Is this person going through a rough patch and, you know, there's some issue that needs to be worked out here? If so, how can we try to work with them? And then if it's a case where, no, clearly this guy is just playing the market, now then we move on. Step two is kind of the stick, and we kind of re-increase your property tax, or we give you fines, or you know, whatever other techniques you can use. So I think, yeah, that would be a big step forward if every local authority in the country, for example, had a really serious well-staffed, well-resourced, full-time unit dealing with the issue of vacancy that kind of does actually try to engage with people in the first instance, and then kind of moves on to the punitive stuff. And actually, if we really simplify things, because one of the issues in Ireland is the fact that, okay, we do have actually fines for people leaving homes vacant, but then you see every week so-and-so owner has managed to appeal that to the court and got it struck off the register. Or you see that, for example, the government has, I think they're offering supports for every local authority to actually hire like a full-time vacant housing officer. Less than half the local authorities in the country have actually taken up, like, basically what's free money, a free worker to come work for you. You know, so there should, and I think that's kind of the problem, is that the government can set these laws and set these regulations, but then they're not really good at enforcing them. And there's too many loopholes. It's too complicated. It's too easy for people to appeal and get out. So I need to really look root and branch. How can we simplify this? How can we just bring it back to the simple objective of, we need these homes to be brought back into use. We have a housing crisis. It's not acceptable to leave homes all over the country that are lying vacant when people need them desperately, you know? When we do have an affordability crisis, and as you mentioned, if you bring on stream a lot more supply, in theory that should make the prices fall, and then you know, a lot more people can benefit, and a lot more people can access housing. So it's really a no-brainer. I think for whatever reason, there's been kind of a lot of feet dragging on this issue over the years, a lack of kind of follow-up from Department of Housing and other department ministries in terms of really making sure local authorities kind of do what maybe they should be doing. And actually, to give you one example, so in France, I should say I live in France, so you know, that's why I have first hand knowledge of this. The government actually sets in law obligations for local authorities to implement, and if the local authority isn't implementing its obligations in housing, the national government will actually fine the local authority. So just one quick example, if you're in a big city in France, like where I live here in Lille, there are minimum quotas for social housing. I think it's about 20%. If you're not hitting that target, then you're paying a fine, and then so the national government sets the obligation, and it makes sure that that obligation is actually being like implemented locally through local government by, you know, also having its own stick that it can use to make sure local authorities going to get their act together in terms of tackling vacancy.
So essentially, for anything to work, unsurprisingly, you need a task force and you need enforcement of the rules, which is where we tend to fall a lot in Ireland, is enforcement. And kind of on that topic of enforcement, we might move on to Airbnb. And
Hi, I am just going to pause the podcast for a second to talk to you about some sponsors of the Crazy House Prices podcast. This episode is sponsored by Daft.ie. Daft is Ireland's number one property portal. Daft has the most properties available for sale and rent and is the preferred national property website amongst consumers in Ireland. So Daft.ie's core vision is to make buying, selling and renting property better for everyone in Ireland. So Daft's mission is to simplify each step of every property transaction in the Irish market to make buying, selling and renting in Ireland simple. That's why Daft.ie build innovative tools like Offers by Daft, an online real-time offers platform that provides never-before-seen transparency for the Irish consumer when buying a home. Are you looking to buy? Maximise your chances of finding your dream home by visiting Daft.ie, Ireland's number one property website.
The obvious impact that has on supply, especially in, like you mentioned earlier, about those kind of holiday hometowns, like they're decimated for rental supply. They've literally nowhere. But you might find 200 properties on Airbnb. Cities, obviously, massive. Recently, New York brought in that rule on Airbnb. I'm sure you've kind of seen that one, have you? The Inside Airbnb Twitter account is quite good for, you know, breaking it down, but essentially overnight they brought in these laws in New York to make it not an actual ban on Airbnb, but you have to be registered, you have to have, you know, approval, and then it needs to be what Airbnb was originally brought in for, which was, you know, owner occupied and you're renting out your spare room. And if you're renting out an entire home, you need to have the appropriate permits over there or whatever it is. And I think within 24 hours they had something like 12,000 properties come on the long-term rental supply, and I think since then, over the last few weeks, it's nearly all of them have now transferred over to long-term rentals. So that is obviously because they're enforcing it and they're not being laxy-daisy with the rules and allowing people get out of it. So what could we do? Do you think we could look at something like that here, or are we hindered by European laws that we can't do that? Do we need compulsory purchase order changes, all that kind of stuff? What could Ireland do in terms of trying to tackle the negative impact of Airbnb?
Yeah, so I think we probably were hindered a bit by EU law in the past, because Airbnb, I think it was Paris, they took to court because Paris brought in basically laws similar to what you just described there for New York, like people having to register and so on. Airbnb took them to court and won a case basically where the European court said, well, no, Airbnb is not obliged to enforce local law. They're just like a service provider. They're like the platform. It's up to the individual households to make sure that they're conforming to the law. Now, the European Union has changed legislation on that with the Digital Services Act. Now there are new obligations basically for short-term lenders to kind of share information with cities and so on, so cities can know who is or isn't renting a property in Airbnb. Also, a lot of cities, I don't know if you use Airbnb, hopefully not. But if you do, you might go on there, you might see a lot of cities now, in all the photographs of the apartment, there'll be like a registration number at the bottom. And that basically means that that property is kind of registered with local authority. The local authority can check, okay, is this on our register? Yeah, it is. Okay. How many nights a year is that property being rented out? Is it going over the limit that we set? So, you know, I was at a conference actually last week with the deputy mayor of Paris, who is in charge of housing issues in Paris. But he made the point, and it's as he said, it's really fair enough. If you're, for example, renting an apartment, you're struggling to make ends meet every month, but you need to go away on holiday, or you have to leave your apartment for a couple of weeks for some reason, right? But that will obviously incur a cost for you. Can you afford to meet that cost, plus also paying your rent on time? So Airbnb does have a very useful and valuable role to play in that kind of like short-term kind of need where someone's renting out a room or renting an apartment just for like a very short period of time, but it is still their home. Where things got out of hand, and that was the original ethos for Airbnb. Yeah. That worked quite well, but where things obviously got out of hand, I mean, I was in Lisbon years ago, and then went back to the same neighborhood of Lisbon like 2 years ago, and I was like, wow, I mean, there are no actual Portuguese people here, it's all Airbnb. It's incredible. And there are plenty of places around Europe where you go to different quarters of the city. I mean, I know Venice is a huge problem with this, and you kind of think, are there actually any locals here? No, it's all Airbnb. Okay, grand. And clearly that's not what you want. You don't want people being pushed out of their homes. You don't want gentrification. You don't want to be woken up at 3 a.m. by a stag party every other weekend. So that's not what Airbnb should be about. So I think now we do have new rules from the EU that can help to tackle that. But one thing that I've always been puzzled by in the Irish case is that In SI Misunderstood, already Airbnb was in conflict with Irish planning legislation, because if you were renting your home out on Airbnb, that basically you need to have a planning as if you're a hotel or something like that. So in theory, all full-time Airbnb apartments in Ireland were in violation of planning regulations, which meant that they should have been kind of easy to prosecute. But for some reason, that didn't really seem to happen. I don't know why. I know people often try to use planning as kind of a way to tackle Airbnbs unsuccessfully for whatever reason. But I think now with the new EU legislation, everybody's going to have to share with, like, you know, Dublin City Council or whatever, who is renting their home for how many nights at what terms and so on. Then Dublin can say, okay, we're going to limit you to a maximum of 20, 30 nights in a year. Anything above that and you're in violation and there's going to be a fine. Like, I'm looking here at Inside Airbnb, just here in front of me. So there's 8,724 apartments listed in Airbnb in Dublin at the moment. And over half of those are full homes or apartments.
If you're on Daft, like how many homes exactly you have to rent on Daft? Probably 1/10 of that. So it's obviously a massive issue. So let's say you're the Minister for Housing and you actually do want to increase private supply and you do want to bring down housing affordability, what could you do
in terms of Airbnb kind of stuff, or just
what kind of enforcement? So are you saying they just an outright ban on entire homes for over 30, any homes that are available for more than 30 days?
Yeah, I mean, basically Airbnb should be confined to what it was originally meant to do, which is people who have a genuine, like, short-term vacancy in their property or have a spare bedroom that they want to rent out, but it's still their primary residence. That's fine as long as it's done within kind of limited terms. But clearly you just want to outright ban any possibility for a full apartment that could be or should be used as someone's home.
Yeah.
Just basically becoming like a de facto hotel.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't work, like I said. I mean, you do see, not just in Ireland, but like all over Europe, people are just pissed off basically with the intrusion of kind of like tourism into areas that isn't set up to cater for that kind of market, you know? And people are pushing back, and you know, a lot of cities, I mentioned Venice earlier on, they're really pushing back. A lot of cities are just fed up, and now they're saying, look, no, this needs to stop. You know, Airbnb for the original ethos, yes, Airbnb as like a full-time de facto hotel business, no.
So I guess it would just need to be sorted which type of homes on Airbnb would actually, so if it's suitable to actually be a long-term home, well, then it should be banned. But then you get the little likes of the log cabins, the little things. Like, I remember we stayed in an Airbnb in East Cork and it was gorgeous, sitting on a little river. But it was basically this little shed this fella built into the side of a cliff beside his house, and it wouldn't be suitable, you know, to live in. But as a little Airbnb, it's perfect, and that would be listed as an entire home on Airbnb, because you're not, you know, it has its own door, its own toilet, you know, it's its own little unit, I guess. But it wasn't a home, you couldn't live in it. So I think it wouldn't be fair for him to be banned. You know, I think that should be allowed to be on Airbnb, because it's not an actual house. But then, you know, if my neighbor's house gets sold and a fella buys it and then he has it rented out 4 or 5 nights a month for $1,000 a night, and then the rest of the month it's sitting there vacant, I think that kind of use of it should be banned.
Yeah, no, absolutely. If a home is clearly meant to be used as like a primary residence, then you should be banned to be full-time Airbnb. If, as you said, it's like the cute log cabin you see in around the country, or like, you know, I stayed in a yurt at the foot of Carrantula a couple of years ago. Clearly no one is looking as a yurt as a long-term housing solution. Well, maybe they are, but I suspect most people who listen to this podcast are not thinking, yeah, a yurt is really where I need to end up with my family, you know. It's clearly meant as kind of a bit of a novelty glamping kind of thing, and clearly that's not a primary residence. So yeah, absolutely, that guy shouldn't be penalized.
So I guess, just to, because I know we're going on now, but to, let's say if you were to give your top three things that the government could and should do, pre-measure, whether it's around vacant housing, whether it's around Airbnb, whether it's around planning changes, whether it's around making building homes more viable, whether it's around modular homes, whatever, what would be your top three things that you think will produce the best results for people?
Oh, I mean, you're killing me here. I mean, this is like Sophie's Choice, my top three only. I mean, I just wrote a whole report in which I had like 50 recommendations. So picking me top three, that's really rough. Look, again, I think there is probably a gap in the market that could be filled by that kind of Swedish type of cooperative housing I talked about, specifically for people who really want to own their own home. I think it's a natural approach. There is clearly an avenue there for the likes of AIB or Bank of Ireland to get back into lending in terms of developing new homes. But where that kind of lending is de-risked, so we don't end up back in the situation where we had with like a banking crisis and a bailout and all the rest of it. So that would be one thing I'd probably look at. The other thing I look at, which I don't think we mentioned already, so would be kind of a national housing fund, effectively.
Like in France.
Exactly, yeah. So again, in France, basically everyone has what's called a livret A, which is kind of like a savings account. I guess it's probably a bit like the SSIA. I don't know the age demographic of your listeners. Maybe they're too young to have had an SSIA. I know I was. But basically just like a savings account where the government gives you a pretty decent rate of interest. I haven't at the moment. My interest rate is, I think, about 3.5%, which is tax-free, which is pretty good because my current accounts give me nothing. And basically, you pool household savings into one national fund, and then that national fund lends money at favorable interest rates to people to build housing. It's a pretty simple, actually, model. You pool, it's almost like a crowdfunding for housing, you know?
As far as I'm aware, that is the only bank that has never gone bust, is it? Or something like that? Some mad stat about it.
I hope it's not the only bank that's ever gone bust. I don't think things are that bad in Europe. But I know, and like this bank has existed in France since the 1870s or 1880s. And indeed, yeah, it's never gone bust. It's never needed a government bailout. It's like it's a really interesting model. And at the moment in Ireland, we went from a situation like kind of pre and post kind of boom years to having like too much debt to having a situation now where we've got too much savings. So basically people are constantly kind of worried about like, oh, is the next crash coming? Okay, I better put a bit of money aside just in case. So people are always looking over their shoulder, which is probably fair enough in Ireland. We do tend to have booms and busts.
Yeah. But you're right. I was wrong there. It wasn't the only, obviously loads of banks have never gone bust, but that one has been around for a couple of hundred years and there's never been any problem.
No, it's really a gold standard. Like people in France put their money into that savings account because again they get a decent rate of return and they know whatever happens, that money is safe, basically, you know?
Yeah.
So it's a really, really low risk kind of way of doing it. And it's really, and the good thing about it as well is that, you know, I get 3% interest today, but I'd be happy with 2% or even 1% because that's still better than what I get in my current account. You know, I'm what they call like a passive investor. I don't really care about my rate of return. Whereas if you're kind of like only accessing private markets, they do care about their rate of return. Interest rates are going up at the moment. Bond yields are going up. Not to get too boring for your listeners, but basically it's now more expensive today for builders or developers to borrow money privately to build homes. And that's going to have an impact on supply, obviously.
Yeah.
Whereas,
so that's your co-op model, your public bank in France. And what will be your next one? Your
third. Oh, God. I have the list open here in front of me and they're all my babies. I don't know which one to pick. I'll give you one because it's probably relevant for people who listen to this podcast, which would be kind of the youth housing scheme they have in Denmark. So in Denmark, I think I put it in the report, they have the lowest or the second lowest rate of young people living at home, whereas Ireland we have one of the highest.
I mean it's
you know yourself, the number of young Irish people living at home is really just crazy. I mean, the average age now that a young Irish person manages to actually leave the family home is 28. Whereas if we go back to the early 90s, by the age of 28, two-thirds of people in Ireland own their own home. Now, there are differences. They're there. People are getting married at a later age, having kids at a later age, all the rest of it. But, you know, it's still an interesting statistic, I think. But anyway, in Denmark, the average age someone leaves the family home is 21. And one of the ways in which they facilitate that is by having affordable housing, which is basically cost rental housing. Affordable cost rental housing specifically targeted at young people. So the way they think about it in Denmark is, okay, if you need to move from, you know, somewhere where there isn't that many employment opportunities or education opportunities to Copenhagen or somewhere else, you don't want those people to be shut out of the market. You don't want people to say, I'd like to go to university, but I can't because I can't access housing. And I know in cities like Galway in Ireland, that's actually a thing that happens, that people don't go to university or they end up living 40, 50 minutes or even further away from universities because they can't find anywhere to live, which shouldn't be happening. Yeah. So Denmark kind of tries to be proactive on that. And it says, no, we're going to build housing. We're going to reserve it for young people who need to kind of move, access education, access employment. That gives them kind of a foothold that they can kind of grab onto, get themselves set up, gives them a bit of breathing space while they're trying to work things out. And then maybe a couple of years down the road, they can rent privately or they can buy their own place or even live in social housing, which is also really high quality and really comprehensive in Denmark. So it's really important to give people that foothold because, you know, just getting out of your parents' bedroom, your spare bedroom rather, is can feel like a big achievement for many people in the country. So if the government said, look, we're reserving these homes just for you, that would be a huge kind of boost to people, give them kind of a bit of light at the end of the tunnel where they think, look, okay, maybe I have to wait a year on the waiting list or maybe a bit longer, but there is an option for me, like a viable option where I can get a good quality apartment at an affordable price. And it means I can take up that place in college, or I can take up that job or that traineeship, and, you know, I can build from there. Because the problem is that it's really hard for young people, as you know, to just kind of get a foothold and start somewhere that they can then hopefully build towards maybe owning a home in the future.
Well, I think the main problem with young people, because I see it as a teacher, I see student teachers come in. You know, I always have student teachers in every year. And I can't remember the last time one of them said to me they planned on staying and teaching in Ireland, because literally their entire class, you've got entire cohorts, are leaving. So if young people don't see that short-term future here, they think, well, I'm just going to go off, I'm going to leave. And I know historically in Ireland that's always been a thing. We've tend to, you know, we leave when we're young, we go off, we get a bit of experience around the world and we come back. But we're at a point now where we are so, like, struggling so much to find nurses, teachers, guards, whatever, those kind of public sector workers, the front line, even doctors are leaving. Like, I don't know any other generation where a doctor couldn't afford to live in Ireland. You know, they're usually one of the higher paid ones. So with a scheme like that, like they have in Denmark, where I think it's, they're around 4%, we're around 40% of people in their 30s living at home. If we were able to give young people like a chance, and then they would see that they have a future here, rather than availing of the CAO, availing of getting their degree and then just getting out of here. And that would kind of reduce that brain drain that we tend to see historically, especially when we're in periods of where cost of living is excruciating. So that's three out of, I know you've about 50 something solutions there. Have you got them like in a document that I could, like, you know, link and people could download?
Yeah, so I'd say to people, just, you can go to our website, which is housingeurope.eu. There's a section there called Observatory. If you go in there, you'll see all of our recent reports. So there's one called Tools to Deal with Vacant Housing, which has kind of a lot of the tools that I already mentioned in the report, and kind of gives you a much more comprehensive and articulate overview of the issue than I was able to give here today. I was woken up at 6 a.m. this morning by my two-year-old. So that's always
fun. I know that feeling.
When you need to do a podcast.
I'm here since the quarter to six.
So that one of Vacant Housing, which is as you said, you couldn't get through it. It is long. I apologize for that, but I'm one of these people who likes to be thorough. And then the other one, which is, I think, even longer, is the other report, Delivering on Housing in Ireland, a European Policy Perspective. And that kind of really breaks it down. What are the main issues in housing in Ireland around affordability, access, new supply? One thing which we didn't really get to mention today, which is, I apologize, which is actually quality. So things like making sure homes are well insulated and all the rest of it. Because it's one thing buying a home, and you do see people buying homes over the country that then turn out to be pretty low quality. So they can buy the home, but then they live in really bad conditions because they can't afford the renovations. And that's kind of that's probably a podcast for a different day.
Yeah,
but it kind of breaks down. It breaks those issues. And then the last section of that report, I have, I think, 20 odd policy recommendations that Ireland could be or should be looking at in order to make sure that we do tackle some of these issues around supply, access, affordability, climate proofing, and all the rest of it. So that's there. And there's all other reports about youth housing and homelessness and all sorts of things that we didn't get to talk about today that are important.
Yeah.
But look, maybe we'll speak again. Who knows?
Yeah, I guess, like, obviously if the homeless figures would reduce, if we fix all the other things as well, you know, and that's a whole thing on itself. So I'm not, you know, avoiding the homeless thing. It's something I'm always talking about, but it's definitely warrants its own podcast, probably its own, you know, dedicated podcast weekly all about homelessness, because I know that's a huge part of the work you do and people in vulnerable situations and figuring out housing solutions for them. I will try and see, can I get those observations and put them all into kind of one document or something. But I guess, like, none of this is a secret. You know, you're not working over there in Europe and keeping all these solutions to yourself. This is all widely available. This is all, you know, widely known, which kind of leads me to the question of why is it not being done here, especially in Ireland? Do you think is it down to a lack of political will? Is it down to a lack of, it's definitely not down to a lack of money, because, you know, we have money. So what is it? Why do you think we're not doing all of these solutions that you guys tend to recommend?
So one thing that never ceases to amaze me in my job is actually how you think that all these schemes that I've been talking about here today are really well known. And They're actually not. Like that French savings model that I talked about, as far as I can tell, as far as my research has found, France is the only country in all of Europe that has that model, even though it's a no-brainer. It's a really, really simple model to deliver more housing for people who need it, you know, by taking kind of a crowdfunding approach. And yet, if you talk to people in Germany, you talk to people in the Netherlands, oh, do you see what the French are doing? No? What is it? I have no idea why, but good policy seems to have difficulty. It goes up to a national border and then stops. Mm. And that's actually one of the things that myself and my colleagues in Housing Europe spend a huge amount of time on, is trying to go to as many conferences, do as many op-eds in media outlets as possible, do things like today's podcast, for example, to just try and spread the word to people about what is actually possible in other countries. So even if you take Denmark, Austria, Finland, countries that are typically held up as having really good housing systems, and they do have good housing systems, you know, they still have problems that could be solved based on policies that are being implemented in neighboring countries.
Yeah.
But they're just not aware. And in fairness to the Irish government, I will say, through things like the housing agency, for example, the Irish government has, for the past 5 or 6 years particularly, but even before then, has been putting an awful lot of money into commissioning people like myself to write reports of them, where we do try to put forward different solutions. And actually, of all the countries in Europe that I speak to on a regular basis, and again, I have to cover not just Ireland, I cover the whole European continent. Of all the countries I talk to, Ireland is the one that's probably the thirstiest for new information, for knowledge, and for new insights. It's the most open to kind of new perspectives. I'm not going to name names, but there are many countries in Europe that do a lot of navel gazing in housing policy. Hmm. And Ireland, in fairness to them, isn't one of them. In terms of why it isn't being done, or why the policies we put forward aren't being done, I can only speculate on that one. I'd say probably, yeah, maybe part of this has to be due to political ideology. Maybe, yeah, they just don't see the need for it. Or maybe they think that the current situation that we're in is kind of like some abnormal situation. And actually, at some point down the road, we'll get back to the way things used to be in the 70s and 80s in terms of how housing was delivered and so on, yeah. Which isn't going to happen because, you know, people, as I said earlier, people are getting married later, they're having kids later. The way in which people kind of live and the way in which they, yeah, the type of housing they need at different stages of life is completely different than it would have been for our parents' generation and certainly for our grandparents' generation. So I think people need to accept that and think that we're not going back to some sort of normal, you know, where we came from, that's done. We need to think about the housing system for today and for the future. So I think that the penny has dropped probably on that one now, finally. So I think we will hopefully see a lot of these policies being adopted in the future. I can't give an exclusive, but I have talked to people from the Department of Housing and other kind of, let's say, influential public agencies in Ireland about some of these policies recently. I know that they are looking at implementing some of them at the moment. I don't know what work has been done in the background to get the pieces in order to do that. Mm. Let's see. And also, I don't know if your listeners are aware, there is the ongoing Housing Commission, which is kind of like this huge expert pool who are kind of putting together very, very detailed recommendations to the government on modifying the housing system, and hopefully that actually manages to change things fundamentally, because I think, you know, we can't go on the way that we have been. You know, Ireland is a different country than it would have been in the past, and, you know, clearly then for we need a different approach.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's encouraging to hear that they are more open than other European countries and other governments maybe that you've spoken to in terms of solutions, and that is generally the vibe I get as well when I talk to Dara Bryan a fair amount. I personally feel like, you know, there is a bit of maybe it's a conflict between them and Fine Gael. Maybe they have different kind of ideologies on where they want things to go. Also, from speaking to, because I've interviewed both of them quite recently for the podcast, and I'm very grateful to both of them for their time. But I do feel like a lot of, like I said to both of them, look, we'll talk again in 6 months and we'll come back about what we spoke about here and see that, you know, have you done what you said you were going to do? And we're kind of past 6 months now with Dara's one, and, you know, things have gotten worse. It's a couple of months since I did the Leo one. And just anecdotally, I just remember talking to him, because I have some ideas, you know, as to, I'm no expert. I understand the frustrations people have, because I have conversations with homebuyers every day. And a simple one for me, that Leo picked up on, because he read my book or whatever, and he said I liked your idea about the probate thing, because I think a lot of houses are tied up in the probate, and, you know, it takes forever, and you could be a year waiting on and a house sale to go through because of the probate. And I just think they shouldn't be allowed to be advertised until the probate's done, which is a simple solution. It's done in other countries. And he thought that was a great idea, but it was just funny what he said. He said, it's a really good idea. So I want to look into it and I want to bring it to our guys, our advisors, and then they can tell me why we can't do it. And then we try and figure it out. And I'm like, that just, it just typifies the whole thing. It's like we'll bring it to you know, these advisors and they'll tell us why we can't do that, instead of saying they'll figure out a way that we can get it done, you know. And I think that kind of maybe is at the crux of where we are, that it's, we're resistant to kind of change, very, very resistant to really investing in this change so that it benefits 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years down the line. And I think a lot of it goes back to this 4-year political cycle we have, because why would they invest in this public bank that's going to benefit the country for 50 years if in 50 years time it's going to be a different government party that is benefiting from their policies. So I just think it's a bit of a mess. And I've always said, I think housing should be removed from party politics 4-year cycles, and it should be a cross-party support for, we're going to take, say, we get Dara Turnbull's document here, and this is what we're going to do for 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 year plan. And no matter who's in government, this is what we sign up to. Do you think that would be good idea?
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree that you can't base housing policy on a 5-year political cycle, because I really hope that politicians don't think about housing in terms of, well, I'm not going to do that policy because I won't be here maybe in 5 years, and I don't want the guy coming in after me to get all the credit for my good work. I hope that when it comes to housing, at least on that one issue, government is always going to put people's best interests at heart.
Maybe I'm too cynical.
No. Like I said, I hope, who knows? Maybe that is the way some cynical politicians think, but I really hope for the sake of the country that's not the case. But the thing about it is, there's very little low-hanging fruit on housing policy. Like, there's very few quick wins. If there are anything that could be done quickly, I mean, vacant housing, that's a no-brainer. Bring that back into use. Maybe do more on protecting tenants and rent regulation. That's kind of something that could be done. Airbnb. So a few kind of small legislative things. But in terms of getting from where we are today of what, building a little under 30,000 homes a year up to where we probably need to be of building probably 50 or maybe even north of 50,000 new homes a year, that's really difficult. That takes a lot of time and effort, and you can't just kind of flick a switch and go from 30 to 50 overnight. You need to put in place all sorts of like funding mechanisms, look at the planning issue, look at the taxation issue, and all the rest of it, and even the labor market, something we didn't talk about. I mean, the labor market in construction is a huge pinch point at the moment for a lot of people who are trying to build homes. I mean, I talked to social housing providers, and they tell me that like they actually do have difficulty getting people that they need to develop out projects, you know, or there could be projects that are half finished, and because you're waiting for some guy to come in who's doing the roof, but he's not available for another 2 weeks, and you know, all the rest of it. So
they're building data centers, and a lot of them, hopefully when this hospital is finally done beside me here, I can nearly see it. Hopefully that, you know, increases the labor supply then, because every more there's, I'm surrounded by building here. There's Newmarket Square is right beside me, literally the bottom of my road, and it's non-stop construction. It's all the hotels built around apartments and student accommodation. So every time I look out in the morning, the park around here is insane. And it's funny to observe, because it's all, nearly every car that comes down, they arrive about 6:30 in the morning, and I'm up at that hour as you are as well, I'd imagine, with the baby. But it's all northern regis, which is really interesting. So it's a lot of labor supply coming down from the north, which I find interesting. But we've talked for long enough. Dara, I really, really appreciate it. I will try and link those observations in the, what do they call them, the show notes or something, in the description under the podcast. But I just want to say thanks so much for taking out so much time to talk to us today.
No bother. And just very cheekily at the very, very end, I'll mention the fact that, so in 2025, the International Social Housing Festival, of which Housing Europe was co-organizer, is coming to Dublin. So it means we're going to get all the brightest minds, all the Dara Turnbulls from around the world will be coming to Dublin to discuss how do we make housing systems fundamentally better, and how do we make them work, and how do we make sure that the people that you deal with every day have better outcomes. So hopefully we'll get a good crowd at that. It's open to anybody who wants to come along and see how things can be done differently. So maybe I'll see yourself there.
Oh yeah, I look forward to it. Well, it's about a year and a half away.
Exactly.
I'll promote it in the early 2025. I look forward to it. Thanks so much, Dara. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
August Shin A, Lion episode shut of the Crazy House Prices podcast. Massive thank you to Dara for such an enlightening conversation. Really, really appreciate it. As I said at the start, you know, you need to take notes and these things. However, I have linked the reports in the episode description. So if you click on there, it'll bring you to the Housing Europe reports that they've done on all of this. And as always, a massive thank you to the sponsors of the podcast and the Instagram page and my patrons who allow me to keep these conversations going and the page going and all the rest. So really, really appreciate it. Thanks for taking the time to listen to it. If you feel like sharing it or leaving a review, that would be wonderful. Would really appreciate it. Agus slán go fóill.